There we go.
It's one of the great challenges of being in a human mind, that the habits and coping strategies and behavioral doohickeys that we struggle with are the ones that are the most difficult to change, are the ones that, of course, are put in place during childhood. The mind, or the brain, I should say, neurally, the more we ingrain behaviors and thoughts and the striatum and the motor neurons, etc., the more difficult it is to the wonders of neuroplasticity and the way the mind writes. It becomes more and more challenging to undo bad habits the more ingrained they are in the mind. And it's, ironic to a degree, because the one period of life where you really wouldn't want to put in charge of writing our oldest and most ingrained habits would be childhood, because, there's a number of reasons, too many to go into now, but a few of them is that the child's brain, of course, is not fully wired. The axons from the frontal lobe back aren't yet totally in place, which means that we don't have a very good ability to inhibit fear-driven and extreme behaviors. Cingulate doesn't have enough access to dopamine, so we don't actually have enough awareness or attention to see very often the long-term results of what we're doing. We're not very good, just in general, in childhood, of seeing the long-term repercussions and understanding that there are long-term repercussions for what we do. Even adults often find that difficult to discern. The Buddha said that the difference between a wise person and a fool is simply the ability to see the long-term repercussions of our actions and not just choose thoughts and behaviors that make us feel safe and happy in the immediate short term. Almost all of our unskillful coping strategies that we pick up during childhood are the ones that make us feel safe right here and right now, or as soon as possible, regardless of the long-term consequences. Some examples. For example, if you've ever seen a child being caught in a lie or in a behavior, let's just say caught in a behavior that they know is wrong, they might tell a lie. No matter how brazen and obvious it's a lie, they'll insist, "No, I didn't." They might have the cookie in their hand and insist that they don't have it. They might run away. Or they might throw a tantrum to try to get what they want. And we develop all these coping strategies, some of which, as we move through lives, get discarded because they're so unrewarded by people. For instance, if every time you want something, you just throw a fit, you start cursing, or whenever somebody, catches you doing something that's unskillful, you immediately tell the first lie that pops into your mind. Over time, you'll probably lose most of the people in your life. I mean, you begin to see, well, these kind of coping strategies or these things that used to work, well, they don't work around the time that we're 8 or 10 or whatever. We begin to realize, the strategy isn't really paying off. But there are a lot of strategies and coping mechanisms that we do carry throughout the entirety of our lives. And we don't get them wiped away. They're, in fact, the ruts the Buddha called. He gave them various names: asavas, anusiyas, fetters. The Buddha loved chronicling all of the bad habits of the mind and talking about ways to undo them. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Just looking through, there's so many lists that the Buddha gave of mental and bad actions that we fall into, or bad habits. I'll give you a list of some of them, and then we'll talk about the ways that the Buddha came up with to undo some of the habits that cause ourselves stress and suffering and make life more difficult. Again, all these things that I'm going to read off, they pay off in the short term. Nobody gets addicted to crack because in the short term it feels bad. Nobody gets wasted, drunk, hides from, uncomfortable situations if it felt bad immediately. No, all of our bad habits generally work. That's why we have them. The problem is they only work for a very short period of time. And then, in the long term, it takes a lot of effort to either deny the bad long-term results or to undo them. For example, if we tell a lie to get out of something unskillful we've done, at first it excuses us from the repercussions, but then we've got to carry around that lie, right? We've got to carry around that story. We've got to remember all the details. If you're a talented liar like I was when I was a kid, you make up all these details because that's the key to a successful lie. You got to throw in a detail that's just so specific that people will be like, oh, well, maybe he's not lying because that's such a specific detail he gave. He even listed the color of the bus that ran him over, which is why he couldn't go to school. But and then you've got to go, carry around the story. And all that effort to carry around these unskillful actions vastly undoes the relief that they gave us in the short term. So in the long term, all the effort it takes to undo or work our way around the long-term repercussions of unskillful actions dwarfs the security that they give us in the short term. But here are some of the, from various lists of anusiyas or bad habits we fall into. The first is denial, which is a form of ignorance, which is basically, it's your fault that I'm suffering, that I'm stressed out. We all get stressed out. We all at work feel overwhelmed. We all feel during our days like the world is on our shoulders and we've got too many things to handle. But the tendency is to, get home or to get someplace and to find somebody and say, when they ask for one thing that we can't deliver, instead say, well, I'm a little bit overwhelmed right now. We say, why can't everybody leave me alone? It's your fault. It's the world. It's not me who put myself here. It's not all the things that I'm carrying around in my mind, all the different to-do lists, all the stress in the body I've been accumulating without working on. It's not all the voluntary things that I've signed up for. It's not all this stuff that I'm doing. It's you. It's the world. Now, of course, the world plays its part, don't get me wrong, but when we move into the spiritual life and begin to examine how we use the mind, especially in meditation, we notice just how much of the stress that we build up in life is actually not the result entirely of the world, but largely the result of carrying around worries about what's going to happen to me in the future, what happened to me in the past, what are people thinking about me, what's my reputation. All this stuff that we do with the mind makes work or makes life seem overwhelming. And when we begin to practice skillful mindfulness of just keeping the mind away from all that extraneous effort, suddenly so much of which seemed insurmountable can become very, very surmountable. In fact, when I've spoken with monks who have unbelievably packed schedules, and they're always totally relaxed. From the moment they wake up until the moment they fall asleep, they have one thing to do after another very often. And they never accumulate the stress that we do because they're very focused on knowing how to use the mind without adding all the unnecessary stress and suffering. But the first thing that we do that points us in the wrong direction is we get this idea that if only this job were different, or if only this person were different, if only I didn't have this thing or that thing, and, you know, that would mean that I wouldn't have stress. And that's actually not the case. If you reflect through life, whenever we change something external, all of our stress hasn't magically disappeared. We're not suddenly all at peace. So this habit of blaming people and the world around us for the fact that we're having difficulties is one of the chief forms the Buddha kept going back to. He also talked about we have a tendency to not have faith in anything that we have seen in the long term brings us peace, but doesn't bring it right away. For example, it's very hard to start exercising because when you go to the gym at first, nothing happens visibly, right? You could exercise for 7 hours and still, you know, really, it takes a long time for there to be any payoff. But on the other hand, most of our addictive strategies or our bad habits immediately have some sort of payoff. They make us feel better. It's much, you know, that's why so many people take steroids, because they can't wait for, you know, or they just can't be with whatever are the skillful long-term results of their actions. They need to manage it and make it happen really much quicker and much more ballooned than it's supposed to be. So we have this with meditation. When we first sit down, it could be not only when I first, for this first, you know, 5 years even sometimes, when we sit and we start our practice, we might not find any immediate results. We might not find that there's any payoff. We might fall into the mind and notice it, and it might for years be really agitated. So there's this lack of faith that we bring, or this tendency to not trust anything that doesn't pay off right here and right now. The Buddha talked about evasion. In one of my favorite teachings, the Buddha talked in the Fruits of Contemplative Life. He says that the most irritating people to him were the people who, when he caught them in a difficult situation, or when he had to have an uncomfortable, you know, encounter where, you know, important things would be discussed, they would try to avoid it. They would avoid, you know, acknowledging their errors, avoid showing up for important events. Any kind of evasion gives us, of course, when we learn to avoid the things we don't like, whether it's important but difficult conversations with the people we love, or when it's doing things that don't, you know, immediately reap benefits. What we're training the mind is to basically do this whole idea: if we don't see it, it's not there. If we hide up in our rooms, or we isolate, or we just don't show up for the complex and often challenging events that we have to show up for in life, that somehow they'll go away. And all that happens in life, in fact, when we avoid discomfort, is that those discomforts mount, and we become more and more frightened. This is how people can go from being entirely outgoing people to being agoraphobic in only a very short period of time, just by slowly beginning to avoid discomfort or uncomfortable social situations. They spend more and more time isolating, and then suddenly they become people who can't even leave the house. I've spoken with people who have had severe agoraphobia, and they don't notice that gradual shift that just happens. So avoidance can be a really serious behavioral pattern to fall into in terms of its detrimental effects. There's, of course, addiction to anything. I'm not talking about necessarily drugs or alcohol. We can have addiction to spending, addiction to work, addiction to food, addiction to relationships, addiction to anything that we're external that we're trying to get all of our happiness or our sense of peace and lasting security from, it's not going to work. And the problem is, though, that we become the problem with craving and addiction is that eventually it's not so much any of the benefits that the thing brings to us that we are addicted to anymore. It's just the discomfort that arises when we don't follow that habit. If you're addicted to something, whether it's gambling or work or whatever, when you don't release all the dopamine that's involved in the addictive pattern in the brain, when you're not doing it, the brain's like, what am I doing? I'm not gambling. I'm not at work. I'm not carrying my work around. I'm not thinking about what's happening at the office, or I'm not thinking about, what's going on in the stock market. I'm not thinking about this. I'm not thinking about that. The brain begins to have an entire pattern of neural transmitter releases that becomes extremely ingrained and very, very difficult. So it's very important not to fall into these loops. The skillful things that we can become addicted to, for example, meditation, generosity, these things don't actually have a lot of dopamine release. You don't really get addicted to them. You just don't. Too bad, right? But we don't. Or maybe it's good. A big one is self-conceit, which is sakkaya ditti in Pali, the Buddhist language, which means that story about ourselves that we carry around. The little mini autobiography, yes, you, I'm talking about you. We all carry around our story, how we've overcome those great hurdles. Nobody's truly seen how wonderful we are. With quivering lips, we think about. So we go back to these stories because we often feel at times even at a complete loss as to why we do the things we do. And our stories, we keep on modifying to try to make sense of all of the thoughts and bizarre behaviors and addictions and habits and all the things that we do. And of course, I'm not going to go into it now, but the Buddha said, in fact, this story is an illusion, that we are, in fact, just an endless source of thoughts and actions and behaviors, and it's our path in life, if we want happiness, to simply begin to practice the skillful ones and let go of our unskillful habits. So there's a million, there's so many lists and so many bad habits that we can fall into that cause stress and suffering, you know, from being uncomfortable with silence to, I can't even name them, I just won't even bother. But I'm going to talk briefly about some of the questions the Buddha said we should ask to try to dismantle them, and then some of the skillful habits we should do or develop to undo our bad habits so that we actually can develop patterns and behavior that give birth to long-time peace. Some of the questions the Buddha said is, if we're doing something that's unskillful, if we're caught again and again and again when we're stressed out at work needing to go out and shop, or I used to unconsciously always steal pens and post-its from work when I was unhappy and stressed out. God damn them, shove a pen inside of my bag, as if coming home with you know, having a house crammed with pens and post-it notes, which I don't even really use post-it notes, which is I spent my 30s hoarding post-it notes and there's really no use for them in my life. I don't really, you know, I'm not the kind of person that writes little notes and slams it on things. So I don't know why I had so many. Eventually I just started giving them all away and all the pens away because I just didn't want to have this stuff that I had taken out of stress. But when we're caught in a behavioral loop, one of the first questions to ask is this something that I really, is this a seed that I've planted that I really want to water? Do I really want my brain to be like this? And the Buddha said anytime we give energy, he was actually very neurally insightful. There's a saying amongst neuroscientists that when neurons fire together, they wire together. The more we think the same thoughts or do the same actions, the more hard-coded they become. So when we think something or we plan to do something, is this really the kind of mind that we want to live in the future? Because any action we take, if we give enough cortisol and enough dopamine to it, it could literally become hardwired in the brain. Another question that's one of my favorites that the Buddha asked, it's a little bleak, but he said, whenever you're thinking something, ask yourself, is this the last thing I would want to be thinking if I died right now? Now, I should give you a little background on this. The reason why that's important is in the Buddha's time, it was understood that the last intention or thought that you had played an enormous role on what future incarnation you would have. Now, I personally am not, I don't really focus or think about reincarnation or rebirth, but in the Buddhist time, there was this idea that, of course, all the actions in your life and all the intentions mounted up, but one thought or intention had more power than most of them, and that was the very last thought you had. If you had led a life of a scoundrel, but your very last few thoughts were those of generosity, you wouldn't have a great rebirth, but it wouldn't be as bad as it could have been. And vice versa, if you had led a very pure life, but at the very end were filled with jealousy, then your rebirth, it was taught, would be much lower than it could have been. So the very last thought you had was indeed very important. Now, I just tend to think, like, I don't really, well, that's not something that I totally work with, the rebirth idea. I do believe that it is worth asking, is this a kind of thought that I would want to have locked into my brain? If this was the last kind of thought that I would ever have, if I couldn't think any other way, would I want whatever I'm thinking or planning right now to be that thought? Another question that's asked from the Pali Canon, this is one of my favorite. There was this idea that the enlightened could read our thoughts, could actually reach into our mind and know what we were thinking. It's said, in fact, that's one of the payoffs of enlightenment and profound mindfulness, is that you can actually hear what other beings are thinking. Now, it's an interesting thought. If whatever you're thinking could be actually heard by somebody else, would you be proud of it? I actually ask myself this when I'm walking around in a, you know, a little bit bent out of shape about whatever's going on in life. I ask myself, well, wait a second. If Ajahn Jeff, my teacher, could read my mind right now, would this be something that I'd want him to actually know? I think that this teaching comes into place because when we're really, really caught up in unskillful thoughts, when we're really, really driven by craving and addictions or fear, other people can tell, right, when they're really peaceful. When you see somebody who's really messed up, or when you see somebody who's caught up in addiction and you're not, you can pretty much read their minds. I know I can. I see them all the time, actually. Being sober, I meet a lot of people who are still in the just coming out of addictions, and you can pretty much just read what's going on with them by what they say and how they act. You really pretty much know what's going on beneath the surface. So it's worth asking when we're caught up in anything, hey, wait a second, is this something that I'm proud of? Would I want this thought to be stuck in my mind? Do I really want to water this kind of behavior for the future? Or is there some other kind of thought that I'd be much more comfortable with if somebody could read my mind? I think that part of this goes down to that in the world around us, the accomplishments that people are rewarded for are all their external accomplishments. We tend to focus on how much money and fame and popularity and how much work somebody does, you know, and we don't really focus that much on the internal skillful qualities that Madonna or Lady Gaga or whoever has acquired. It's not really like new today in people.com. Lady Gaga achieves a new state of inner peace and serenity through mindful concentration on her breath. You probably will not see that headline unless you're on drugs, and maybe you would, but so we tend to reward just the external accomplishments, and we tend to focus on them, and we tend to think, wow, I haven't accomplished enough in my life. When we say that sentence, we're really thinking about external stuff most of the time. We're rarely thinking, wow, I haven't really attained the jhanas through working with my breath. We're generally saying, well, I haven't written the great American novel or whatever. But we should at least balance. It doesn't mean we have to go 100% in the direction of internal accomplishments, but we shouldn't discard them. We should give them at least as much merit to our internal accomplishment, how much we work on our insides, as how much we accomplish externally. So I'm just going to end with a couple of the things that the skillful things we can do to undo. Things to cultivate. First is wisdom. Which means when we're stressed out, rather than immediately blame the people around us, which is the course of ignorance or the world around us, ask ourselves, what is it that I've been focusing my mind on that I don't have to be? What is it that I've been worrying about? What is it that I've been, am I worrying about what my reputation is or what other people think about me? Am I worried about what's going to happen to me tomorrow? Or what am I carrying around that I don't have to? What thoughts could I just let go of right now and still do a good job and still be present? What could I let go of? That's a really, really important question to constantly be asking. How could I use the mind differently whenever I'm stressed out so that I don't have as much stuff that I'm carrying around? Am I carrying around a to-do list? Am I carrying around a worry about how I'm perceived by others? All this stuff we can often let go of and make what seemed to be impossible very, very possible. So the first thing always to ask is when we're caught about to do something that's unskillful is, well, wait a second. How have I been using my mind? What have I been focusing on? How could I let go of stuff? A second thing is to develop a true commitment to whatever our spiritual practice is. You don't have to be a Theravadan Buddhist like me. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You can be any kind of person you want to be. You don't even have to have a spiritual path with a name to it. Some people's path is involved in doing service in the world that brings them lasting peace. But whatever it is, find a part of your, bring energy, if you can, to a practice that doesn't pay off immediately, that in fact pays off in the long term. A spiritual practice, something that is not based on accruing material rewards, but is based on the feelings of esteem from having doing the act. The Buddha talked about relinquishing via yoniso manasikara, which means when we're caught up in an addiction or a habit, a worry that we often have, rather than push it away. First, just notice it. Watch it. Watch the entire cycle, the entire addictive cycle. Notice what it promises. See if you can figure out what each action we take, or what each behavioral tendency we have, or what each obsessive thought, what is it promising? Ask yourself, if I didn't think this thought or do this action, what would I be living without? And see what jumps to mind. And then see if there is another thought or action that can fulfill that promise. Sometimes, for instance, we have this idea that unless we worry about what other people are thinking about us, we'll be unprepared. We won't be safe. We won't. Unless we guard our reputations, we might not have a good career or whatever. But ask ourselves, is that really true? Is there other ways to protect ourselves without obsessively worrying about what people think about us? And then the Buddha said, when we watch this addictive cycle, just observe it, notice in the long term what kind of stress it involves thinking this way. Is there any other way that we could engage our mind that wouldn't require as much effort? Generosity or forgiveness, you can choose whichever one sounds more appealing. I would say especially forgiveness is an important practice to develop. We have this idea that unless we carry around our anger and disappointment with people, that somehow we'll forget and they'll take advantage of us again. Unless we relive the story of how awful they were, we won't be prepared and we won't know, oh, this person is unskillful and I'll fall into it again. Well, if that's really the way the mind works, you'd have to carry around how to tie your shoelaces around with you all the fucking time, or else you wouldn't know how to do it the next time. You don't need to carry around important information in the mind. If it's important, it actually sticks with you. So the idea that we have to carry around the story of how somebody mistreated us, or else we might fall victim again. Oh, I better remind myself of how bad such and such people are in relationships with me, because if I don't, I'm going to fall back into... I heard once somebody told me, who was sober, he said, I'm never, ever, 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 ever going to get in a relationship with a recovering alcoholic woman. Ever, 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 ever again. And I was like, well, that's fine. You don't have to. But do you really need to tell yourself that all the time? Are you really going to forget that? I mean, you don't forget, say, when you're driving your car to stop at the red, right? Without reminding yourself that of it constantly. So we don't need to carry around the important lessons with, you know, that we think in life, whatever, we can actually drop them. You don't have to carry around especially the stories of people mistreating you. I guarantee you, when you see them again, it will all come back. Forgiveness especially is good because it gets that story out of your mind very quickly. If you really can forgive yourself for something that you've done similar and then forgive them, your mind will be such a more spacious place to live in. Patient equanimity, upekkha, is basically seeing when one action or one person we're putting a lot of effort to is not bringing us any happiness, and being willing to put effort and energy into someone else. Equanimity doesn't mean just giving up on humanity or giving up on being helpful or giving up on having relationships. Equanimity means seeing when we're around somebody and we act always unskillful when we're around them, or when we feel we are unsafe when we're around them, or when we feel that they never hear what we're saying, or they never put as much effort and energy into the relationship, or whatever it is you feel. There will come a time in life when you need to rechannel your efforts into someone else. Sometimes we really want the coolest, best looking, funnest people to love us, and sometimes they don't. And we just have to put our energy into the people who do where we can act and be comfortable being skillful. As they put it in one of the 12-step programs, you don't go to the hardware store for orange juice. You go to the grocery for it. If you found out that one of your friends has turned into the hardware store and you need orange juice, the time is to put your effort into another friendship. You don't waste all your energy trying to salvage what can't be salvaged, at least right now. You can always keep the door open. Finally, the last two are honesty and mindfulness. Mindfulness we talk about all the time. It's learning to detach from thoughts and bring your awareness into the body and the breath. And honesty is simply the ability to not avoid or evade the truth, to be willing to acknowledge when we've made mistakes, even when we are really frightened of it. The good news is that we don't need to beat ourselves up. All we need to do is to acknowledge, and that's it. The Buddha never taught beating up yourself if you've made a mistake. The Buddha only said, with anyone else or with ourselves, the only thing we need to do is just acknowledge that that's an action that we don't want to repeat. And that's it. If we owe restitution, we give it. But other than that, there's no beating up of ourselves. So it's not as difficult acknowledging when we're in the wrong, because it doesn't hang over us like the stain that we think it might. So anyway, that was tonight's talk on bad habits, questions to ask of our habits, and new habits to develop. I hope you got something out of it. And thank you for coming. And now if you have any questions or any thoughts on any of the subject or anything you want to share, please do. Hi.
I had a question about thinking.